So I just want to make something abundantly clear to you. You who don't know me all that well, you who see me here on a Sunday or an evening like this, I have a terrible time with time. I am awful at being on time. I don't know if anybody out here is like that, but I am. I just don't do time well. I have wrestled consistently, I think from birth, at being timely. It's like my whole nature simply puts off leaving, and then I'm sprinting to get to someplace on time. And I actually spend a lot of time apologizing for being late. I'm at a point where I think it's disrespectful to be late, and I'm always late. Those who know me in meetings, when I come to a meeting late, of course, this doesn't happen if I'm running it. But if I come to a meeting late and I sit down, I don't start talking. You know how people come in and they sit down, they just start talking? I never do that. Because I chose to be late, which means I chose to give up the privilege of talking. Does that make sense? It is a struggle that I've always had. I've had to figure out in my head what time a meeting is and then tell myself I have to leave a half hour earlier. Because as you know, when you come in, am I here? You have no idea what battle that was to get in the door. Typically, you would be waiting for me and I would run down the aisle going, I'm here, Bob, I'm here. I would do that. My mom, when I grew up, her definition of being on time was to be a half hour early. Most frustrating in the days before smartphones, most frustrating is on Christmas Eve, she insisted that we would be at church an hour and a half early and sit there. Needless to say, as I moved into adulthood, there was a rebellion to that. One year, I had my wife and my kids were little, and we went to visit my parents. It was Christmas Eve, and we ended up sitting in the lobby. She said to us later, "See if you had been on time." And my response was, "I was on time, and I don't care that I sat in the lobby." The irony, and you don't, because you have not been to my home, you don't know this. I collect antique clocks. It's like I wrestle with this thing about time, and then I have a house full of chiming and ticking. And I'm not kidding you. And so we have everything from a German cuckoo clock we bought a few years ago that my wife loves to a Civil War period clock to an English grandfather clock from the 1820s. We got a Westminster chime clock. See, I know about this from the early 1900s, and I have to make sure they're always off a little bit because when it's on the hour, we could have just one big gong. It's the wrestling match of what do we do with time? You see, our opening psalm speaks about that. In verse 4, it says this, "For 1,000 years in your sight are like a day that has gone by, or like the watch in a night." So 1,000 years, it's like 1,000 years goes by. It's like a day, so it goes really, really fast. A watch in the night, they divided the night into four chunks, and a watch lasted about 4 hours. And you would have some guard that was up on the top of the castle wall or in a tower watching for danger, always watching for an enemy. In the ancient world, there were many enemies, and they would attack. And so your watch was to watch for the enemy. It literally, that was your task. Verse 10 says it this way, "The length of our days is 70 years or 80 if we have the strength. Yet their span is but trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away." Ooh. Ooh, so we live our lives and we have our span, but really, look after that next phrase, after the but there, and then after the but, notice what we got? Trouble and sorrow, for they quickly pass and we fly away. Just a little sidebar, the average age of a man in the ancient world was about 45 to 50 years old. And so when he says 70, most people never hit 70. And goodness, if you hit 80, that would be almost miraculous. But they fly by. Life is not easy. The psalmist is very, very clear at noting that life is just simply tough. Yet what we do know is this, and scriptures are very clear about this. If you think about the fourth commandment, Charles, what's the fourth commandment, my pre-sem man, who I've just put on the spot? Oh, you won that one. You won on that one. Honor your father and mother that it may be well with you and that you may live long upon this earth. Meaning, children, listen to your parents, you won't die. That you may live long upon this earth. Notice the fourth commandment is telling us that life is really a gift. That God intends us to live a good and long life. So despite what the psalmist writes in Psalm 90, on the other side of it, it says that life is a gift and it should be embraced. Jesus said this in John chapter 14. He says in 14 verse 6, "The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come that they might have life and have it to the full." That's really John 10:10. But looking at that, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. The thief is the devil. Evil wants to take life away. So when you look at the world around us, Martin Luther said there are three things that are really of sin, that promote sin. One is the devil. The other is the world we live in. And third is simply us. So we can steal and kill and destroy. We can do that. The thief comes. The world we live in can steal life. And of course, the evil one would delight in stealing life from you. But Jesus says, "I have come that you might have life and that life may be full." Jesus wants you to have a full life. John 14, verse 6 says it this way. Jesus says, "I am the way, I am the truth, and I am the life." So as much as the psalmist talks about life being filled with sorrow and struggles and terrible stuff, which, by the way, it is, the other side of it is Jesus is saying, "Wait a minute, I've come to give you life to the full." God says in the commandments that you may live long upon this earth. A long life is a gift from God. The fact of the matter is there are an abundance of biblical references that speak about life being full and complete and satisfying. Time and life are a value to be appreciated, a value that should not be forgotten. Does that all make sense? Does that make sense? Because God gave you a certain amount of time. Remember, every week, how many hours do you have? 168. What do you do with them? What do you do with them? You see, what I find so striking is that to God, time is inconsequential. Time just doesn't mean anything. Think about this, and I have a hard time wrapping my head around this. God lives outside of time. Think of that. God lives outside of time. I don't even know what that means. And I know if I Googled it, there would be somebody who's written papers on these things. They've all written papers on something. But what does it mean to live outside of time? I wonder this one. In Genesis 2, Adam and Eve are created. And I wonder, they were created before time existed? Or what was their definition of time that's different after Genesis 3, when sin enters into the world? So what was time like? You see, my friends, death was not part of creation. Death was not God's plan. We have a beginning of life, a birth, and then we all know that there's an end of life, something called a finite. There's an end, there's a conclusion. We know that there's this continuum then between birth and the time we are called home. That thing is called life. And there's a beginning and an end. But in Genesis 3, death entered, which means that death didn't exist before Genesis 3. Genesis 2, there is no death. Adam and Eve were fully good, complete, satisfied, We know in Genesis 2, in a completed world, there was marriage. And there would be babies. We know that. Genesis 1:31 or so tells us that. Go and multiply the world. And then in Genesis 2:24 it says, get married, leave, cleave, be one flesh. Have a good life. Celebrate it. Enjoy it. In fact, Genesis 2:25 says it this way, and they were naked in the garden and were not ashamed. Think about that. Shame. There was no shame. The nakedness, the mention of nakedness was to say there was authenticity, complete openness, complete trust. But sin came into the world, and then suddenly life became finite, a beginning and an end. Harvey Mackey, who's a well-known New York Times bestseller author, if you Google him, you'll find he's written a whole bunch of things. He wrote this little poem, this little diddly. He wrote this, he said, time is free, but it's priceless. You can't own it, but you can use it. You can't keep it, but you can spend it. Once you've lost it, you can never get it back. Anybody ever wasted time? You can't get it back. Mackey's got it right. Time isn't cheap, even though it's free. Time is a value and never to be treated lightly. We use the time given to us, but we don't own it. It's not in your bank account. The last line I find is a really big one. Once we lose it, it can never be given back. So think of time. You have any regrets that you wish with your time you had done things differently? I'll give you one in my life. There are things about how I raised my children, my daughters, particularly the first one, because they're the experiment. When I look at raising my oldest, there are things that I, as a dad, wish I had done better. Don't anybody else have wishes they had done better? About anything? Not parenting, but anything? Maybe some of you. Debbie, I'm sure you were a perfect parent. No question. Brad's over there nodding. Yes, she was. So you see how this works? Don't we all have regrets of what we've done with our time? And yet, when we look at it, once we use up the time, once you've lost it, you can never get it back. I mean, in one sense, that could be haunting. We're born and we live. We move towards old age. And some of us are further along in that continuum, as I've bumped into, now I'm in my later 60s. And you look and go, I've never thought about being in my older 60s. What does that mean? And I know we have a woman's Bible study that meets here on Tuesdays. Average age is 84 years old. I have checked. The average age is around 84. This is an older group of women. I really delight in them. And what they have done for me, as I've seen them over my tenure here, is how they embrace life. They've taught me something about how to grow old. And during the summers, I have intentionally grilled lunch for them. And so now they're used to it. I think that's good. Whoever the next pastor is, he's got an expectation. I have set him up. But, you know, I'll tell them the menu. This is what I'm cooking on Tuesday. They get all animated. But part of the deal is, because I do like to grill, I'm not doing anything I don't like to do. I like to grill, but I get a chance to sit and talk. And that moment is kind of precious, because you find out, how are they embracing their age? Because our culture is very youth-structured, youth-centered. The problem is, everyone gets old. All of us do. Or as I say to my college students that I teach in my religion classes at Concordia, and I'll talk about time. I'll look at them and I'll say this. Look at your dad and mom. That's your future. And there's always one kid that goes, no, no. I said, sorry, there's genetics here. Sorry, you can fight it off, resist it. But the fact of the matter is we are all on the same timeline. And it ultimately leads to a finality to it all. And God lives outside of time. And I still wonder what time for Adam and Eve was before they sinned in Genesis 3. That's just kind of curious. I mean, those are conversations that don't mean much of anything, but they're kind of fun to talk about. What was time like for them? This is why Galatians chapter 4, verse 4 is such a powerful thing, and I read it on Christmas Eve about a week ago. It said this, when the time had fully come. Look at that. Time had fully come. God sent his son, born of a woman. God, this is what I find so striking to this. God, who lived outside of time, chose to come into our time to live with us and be in our time. He chose it. But what if God lives beyond time, which I've already mentioned and I think is true, and all is good outside of our time? If time is a product of sin as we know it, God, who is above time, is living outside of sin. He's living in the complete wholeness of creation, because God himself is completely whole. And as we know, is the personification of love, because he is love. And then God lives beyond time. Nothing's damaged. Nothing's broken. Nothing ever ages. And then what does God choose to do? God chooses to step out of that. To step out of that. And frankly, folks, into this. Into this. Where time eats away at us from birth until death. In fact, I did read some research. I wasn't happy about it either for this message. That says, the research says that our bodies begin to decay after 30 years old. I was annoyed. And frankly, and I have a link here if you said, oh, I want to read that article. Well, I do have a link. I won't even get into the specifics of brain functioning or organ functioning. Because why? It'll just depress you. That's the fact of reality of life. Jesus, our God, entered into this time-decaying world. And then he says these extraordinary things. I have come to bring you life. I have come to bring you life. And life to the full. Philippians chapter 2, verse 7, this is an ancient creed. So if you look at Philippians chapter 2, 5 to 11, this is one of the earliest confessions of faith that we have from the early church. Very early. Philippians was written around 60 AD or so. So very, very early in our church, in our church life. And it says this in chapter 2, verse 7, talking about Jesus. It says, Jesus made himself nothing. In fact, Paul writes, Jesus emptied himself. Which makes sense. If Jesus lived outside of time and was fully complete, then to come into our time, he gave up something to be in our world. And why would he do such a thing? Because we are valuable to him. No matter what your story is, no matter if you feel value or not value. And I talked to a friend just before I came to church tonight, this afternoon. Talked to him for about an hour and a half. And he's kind of struggling with some things in life. He doesn't live around here. He struggles with some things in life. And at one point I said to him, you are valuable. No matter what voice is in your head that says you are not valuable, you are of value. God did not create you to be a mess. God created you to be worthy. To be worthy. And this strong man who prides himself at his strength got choked up because, you see, he was so broken. Does our world break us? Does it have the potential of breaking us? Yes, it does. It does have the tendency to break us. And on this New Year's Eve night, there are a bunch of the folks that are very, very lonely, and they're saying, well, what do I do with this? This is the night of parties and celebrations. And some of us, maybe we're ill or sick. Or Micah's, you're dealing with the death of someone dear to you. Just doesn't seem right. But Jesus made himself nothing. Jeff read a few minutes ago from Romans chapter 8 and verse 35. Just think about the time. God came into our time Who shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall trouble or hardship or persecution or famine or nakedness or danger or sword? Any of those things happen in our time. Isn't this what we do with our time, is we endure it? Isn't that kind of how we do it? We approach it by enduring time. We'll get through it. We'll just get through it. Again, Psalm chapter 90. The length of our days is 70 years or 80. If we have the strength, yet their span is but trouble and sorrow. Living in this time and in this place really means separation. It does. The thing is, when I say that, when I talk about separation, we don't get it because we're so used to living in this time of separation, that we have no idea what it means to live in a world without trouble or sorrow or separation. Does that make sense? If we live in it and this seems to be the normal, we don't know what it means to be abnormal, because this is the normal. And yet, the reason Jesus came, the reason he intervened into our time, was to say what you think is normal is abnormal, and what I'm calling you to is normal. But you don't know, because you're surrounded by abnormal, a world of survival, enduring, struggle. And by the way, I know not all is bad. We have a glimpse of love, commitment, joy, the look of a little baby, a marriage, graduation, it's finally done. We see these glimpses of possibility, but they're glimpses. Notice this, they're glimpses. Paul continues in Romans chapter 8, and he says in verse 37, in all these things, and then he uses this interesting phrase, we are more than conquerors. More than conquerors. Nothing can separate us from the love of God, because God himself entered into our time, God himself entered into our space. And why did he do that? Because you're valued, because you are important. You're not some survival thing where you just live life and then, you know, so what? No, you're a value. But then he says, you who have the broken time, and you're born and you're living in this decaying body, guess what? Guess what, you folks? He says, you who are followers of Jesus, you are more than conquerors. Now, he writes that in the book of Romans, right? And guess who the book of the Romans were written to? Romans. Where did the Romans live? In Rome. Now, guess what? Rome is where the Caesar lived. Guess what? The Roman army at the time that Paul is writing is the most powerful army in the world. And the Roman ethos, its highest value, was to conquer. That's what they were known for, conquering. All the roads that we know they built, all the engineering that we know about. I mean, Charles, you're going to be with me in Israel next week. I'm just telling you, you're going to see the Roman engineering is extraordinary. It's still around today. But all of those things were built to hold on to the empire, and the road system was built so you could get the army from point A to point B really fast. And they built roads really, really well. They were conquerors. So Paul is very intentional when he chooses the language, and he says, guess what, folks? You Romans, you followers of Jesus in the city of Rome, you are more than conquerors. You know about conquerors because there's always a triumphant parade coming into the city of Rome to celebrate some general again who conquered an enemy. But you are more than conquerors. Which brings us to our gospel lesson from Mark chapter 1. We find out very clearly how Jesus used his time. Because Jesus did have a beginning, right? We celebrated it last week. We make it so nostalgic. Joseph, Mary, manger, angels, shepherds, wise men. They had a hard life. But this birth was miraculous. And then he lives, and you know, we're going to go to Easter, Good Friday, and he dies. He also has to make a decision on what he's going to do with his time. And we find this out in verse 29 of our reading. Jesus left the synagogue. Oh, guess what? It was Sabbath. All religious Jews would worship on Sabbath, no different than followers of Jesus worship here tonight or on a Sunday. He was worshiping. The Sabbath ended. When the Sabbath service ended around noon on Saturday, they would go home, and guess what they would do at noon? Eat lunch. Oh! They go into the house. They had spent time studying Scripture, talking faith, instruction of the Word. Jesus may or may not have done it, but they go back to Peter's house, Peter the Apostle's house, because they're going to go have their Sabbath lunch. Another word for Sabbath is Shabbat, their Shabbat lunch. They walk into the house, and what does Jesus find out? Peter's mother-in-law. Oh, if he has a mother-in-law, that means Peter was married, which means Peter was older. He was between 25 and 30, maybe. Maybe a bit younger. There's some speculation. But he might have been, like, say, 23 to 30. So he's a bit older. The other apostles don't seem to have been married. They were younger. So they go in the house, and the mother-in-law is ill. And so we know from the reading, Jesus went to her, and he healed her. That's what he does with his time. He heals her. Now, the next line is kind of cute. It says, and then the mother-in-law got up and served them lunch. Oh, this was all about lunch. That's what Jesus does with his time. He's a healer. Wherever your brokenness is in your life, wherever you feel inadequate, wherever you feel a bit beaten up, I'm here to tell you, Jesus, in our time, has come to heal you. He doesn't walk away from you. He doesn't abandon you. He comes to walk with you. The timeless one entered into a small stone house, and he heals the mother-in-law, and Jesus demonstrates that our time means something. He does that. Our time means something. He came to our time. He lives in our time. He dies in our time. He resurrects from the dead in our time so we may live outside of time in his glory. The book of Revelation, chapter 22, living in the New Jerusalem. Outside of time. And that's being more than a conqueror. And that's acknowledging that nothing can separate us from the love of God. Absolutely nothing. A blizzard may slow us down like it did in Buffalo. And we had some snow here. That weather has been really weird. Now it's all gone. But it doesn't stop us. So my friends, thank you for spending your time here tonight. Thank you. You made a decision to be here and use a part of your 168 hours to walk in the door here. And I'm blessed to spend this time with you. And maybe somehow in a service like this, we can get a glimpse of the timeless love that God has for us. Maybe. In Christ's name, amen.